Welcome to The Balance. I'm Dr. Catlin Tucker, and this is an Ask Catlin episode focused on assessment. I know as we end the year or we approach the end of the year, assessment is top of mind for a lot of us in education. I've been sharing a lot of reels on Instagram, sharing pre-assessment strategies and formative assessment strategies. And so I've gotten some questions about those. And I have some questions about summative assessments and student agency and how we make assessment inclusive and accessible and equitable for students. So we're going to tackle all of those today. Normally, I have a guest kind of feeding me the questions. Unfortunately, Noelle wasn't able to join me last minute today, so I'm going to be flying solo, but I'll read the questions, I'll answer them, and I do have my surprise question sealed in an envelope thanks to Chris, so I will open that at the end and we'll tackle the random question that I am not prepared for. So the first question I received in response to my reel on pre-assessment strategies was, when do I give pre-assessments? So what we want to do is, as we're ending a unit, that's when we want to be giving a pre-assessment or conducting a series of access prior knowledge activities to try to understand what students think they know or can do, right, in relation to specific concepts and skills. We want that informal data so that as we're designing the subsequent or the next unit, we're using that data to design with a high level of intentionality. You know, learning isn't like lining up for a race. Kids are going to start in very different places in terms of their concept knowledge and skill set. So our job as architects of learning experiences is to gather pre-assessment data, try to assess prior knowledge using a range of different strategies, right? So that could include something like a brain dump or a brain harvest where students share everything they know about a topic in a very short amount of time. It might be two-minute chats with a classmate, responses to an online discussion question. It might be challenging them to create a concept map around key concepts. What terms, ideas do they associate with that concept? Or it might be something as simple as giving them a pre-test or quiz that does not go in the grade book, but is really just to help us understand what do they know and what can they do at the start of this unit so that we aren't spending a ton of time instructionally covering things they already know or boring students who already know something and now they have to listen to it again. But we're not making any assumptions and jumping past stuff that they actually need to be reviewed and covered as part of this unit. So I would really time that pre-assessment for kind of the last quarter of the, or the end quarter of a unit, so that you have enough time to use that data as you're designing the next unit. The second question is, how can I collect formative assessment data that so that the whole process doesn't add to my workload? And I think this question really speaks to the idea that if teachers are building mechanisms to collect formative assessment data, maybe they're trying to check for understanding, that now they're collecting work from students that they feel like they need to spend a lot of time with. And really, formative assessment data, where we're striving within the lesson to check for understanding, hopefully we're not spending a ton of time with that formative assessment data. So for example, as an English teacher, sometimes I would challenge students to do a piece of writing. Maybe it was like construct a thesis statement or try to analyze a quote. And they would just do a quick example for me. And I would collect a bunch of half sheets of paper. And then I would just kind of flip through them. And it only took about 5 minutes. And I would make piles. So I'd make a pile for the students who they got it. They're demonstrating that they understand how to complete whatever this writing task is. Then I would have a pile where it's like, ooh, they get it, but there are still some areas that need fine tuning or adjustment or maybe some additional support from me as a teacher for them to get really solid. And then I would have a stack where it was just students who had not completed the task or clearly didn't understand what the task was. They hadn't done it correctly. And so those three piles would just inform how I might design my teacher-led station, say in the subsequent lesson, if I was going to run a station rotation and I wanted to target my support to the needs of the groups of students based on that formative assessment data that I had collected. But I didn't grade it. I didn't write any notes on it. I didn't even, in some cases, give it back to students. It was really just for me to kind of get a sense of where they at, where would my time best be spent to ensure that they're all making progress forward. How do I challenge the kids who are really strong in this area? How do I support students who are a little bit wobbly and need a bit more instruction or modeling to really fine-tune their skill set? And what kind of reteaching do I need to do for the kids who really don't understand how to execute this type of writing? So we want to be thinking about building those mechanisms to check for understanding into the fabric of our lessons, but we don't want to be spending a massive amount of time writing comments or suggestions. Instead, we want to use it to really inform the follow-up lessons to make sure they are continually adjusting to meet the students' needs. All right, the third question is, how often should I collect formative assessment data? Well, ideally, it would be great to have a check for understanding or some kind of formative assessment check in each lesson, right? Because each of our lessons has some kind of learning objective. Often, teachers are asked by their schools or districts to write those on the board. So it might be a I can statement from the student perspective about what they're going to be able to do or understand at the end of the lesson. So when we have a really clear lesson objective for our class, it makes sense to build in some strategy to check how effective was this lesson at helping students understand that concept or helping them to understand how to apply a specific skill or work through a specific process. So it could be something as simple as an end of class exit ticket where we're trying to collect that formative assessment data and gauge how effective was this lesson at helping students meet that or make progress toward those learning objectives. And again, it doesn't have to be super labor intensive for us, hopefully. An exit ticket is really designed to kind of highlight some patterns of need, identify areas where students are really strong and understanding concepts, are able to apply specific skills or processes. So ideally, it's each day, but keep in mind, formative assessment can also come in just these observational moments that we have when we're in our class, watching students engage in discussion, watching them collaborate around shared tasks. There's a lot of really valuable informal formative assessment data that can be collected simply through observation, as long as we have a quick way to kind of capture that. So, for example, speaking and listening skills were a central part of my work as an English teacher. So students would often engage in what I like to call four corner conversations. And basically, the name tells you exactly what they were doing. They were in each of the four corners of my classroom. There was a small group of students sitting in a circle, and they would have conversations often about the reading from the night before. And as they were engaged in discussion, I would walk around with my seating chart and a pencil, and I would just make notes. Who was clearly understanding the reading? Who was struggling? Who didn't appear as though they had even attempted the reading? So I was making notes, I was collecting data so that I could use that to inform my follow-up lessons, but also to have conversations with students about what I was noticing and observing and where I thought they might want to spend time developing or improving and really trying to understand how I could best support them in that process. So how often should you collect it? As much as possible. That data is so interesting in terms of informing our practice and helping us understand what's working and what's not working for students. All right, the next question. You encourage teachers to use assessment as a metacognitive skill-building tool for students in the book, The Shift to Student-Led. How does that work? It's a good question. So the examples I've given so far, really the formative assessment data has been useful for the teacher. And I think most teachers use formative assessment in this way. It's informal, ongoing data. Often we embed these mechanisms right into our lesson so that we can try to understand how much progress students are making toward learning objectives. When Katie Novak and I wrote The Shift to Student-Led, we also talked about how valuable formative assessment can be as a metacognitive skill-building tool. And what we mean by that is we want to help students think about their thinking. think about their learning in very intentional ways. We want them to understand their own progress. We want them to be able to really identify, what are my strengths as a learner in this class? Where are my areas of weakness or limitation? What specific support from my teacher would be really helpful from my perspective as a learner in helping me continue to make progress? So if we can share formative assessment data with our students, we can help them to understand themselves as learners much more deeply, especially if we build structures around that data. So if we are giving students access to formative assessment data that we have collected, building in a reflective practice, asking students to think about what is this telling them about themselves as a learner, their growth in relation to specific concepts and skills, areas of specific need. It might be even a tool to help them set academic or behavioral goals for themselves in the class as well. So really leveraging this data in dynamic ways to help students develop those metacognitive muscles. An example of that kind of dovetails on the four corner conversation. So eventually, I would assess students on their speaking and listening skills. And I had a single skill rubric. So it was just focused on their engagement in small group discussions. I used the language from our kind of California version of the Common Core around speaking and listening to describe, what does it look like to be in the beginning stages of participation in a small group discussion. And I would use some of the language from the standards about what kinds of behaviors students really wanted to be developing and honing in a discussion. So the first level was beginning, right? And I described, what does it look like to be in the beginning stages? Then there was a second level that was developing. What does it look like to be a participant in a small group discussion if you're in that developing stage? Then there was a proficient and a mastery. And so I would make photocopies of this one skill rubric that had the language describing what each level of mastery looked like. I would cut them into strips. And then as students were engaging in those four corner conversations with their classmates, I would make a habit at least once every grading period, if not more, to have my little stack of rubrics. And as I was walking around observing the groups engaged in discussion, I would write the student's name at the top of the rubric. And I would just circle the language of what I was seeing in terms of their level of mastery participating in these small group discussions. And then at the end, I would just hand them out to the students. I would have them reflecting on what that was telling them about what they were doing well, where they needed to improve. So it was not something I put in a grade book. It's not even something I kept. It was something I gave directly to my students to drive a reflective process, to really get them thinking about their learning and how they were showing up in those discussions so that hopefully the next time we did a four corner discussion, they were performing at a slightly higher level because they knew where they needed to improve and what they need to work on. So anytime we're able to make that formative assessment data available to students and build a reflective or goal-setting kind of experience around it, it can be used to help them develop that metacognitive kind of ability. All right, the next question. If I want to universally design my summative assessments offering choice, how do I handle grading if students are creating different products? I get a version of this question a lot. So obviously my work in the last 4 or 5 years has really kind of collided with the work of Dr. Novak. So my interest in kind of combining online and offline learning and really universally designing that experience has been something I've been focusing on. And so when I talk about assessment, I tell teachers, you know, we need to acknowledge that when we have all students complete one type of assessment, we are potentially not getting an accurate picture of what they know or can do, because we know not all students are going to express and communicate their learning or demonstrate their learning effectively in the same way. So some students might be very skilled at communicating their learning in writing, but there are other students who are going to really struggle to do that. They might have a much better experience if they could verbally communicate their learning or create a visual representation of their learning. And so if we truly want every student to have a pathway to share what they learned as effectively and accurately as possible, providing meaningful choices in terms of those summative assessments can create that flexibility of pathways, allowing students to choose a type of assessment they think will be most effective for them to share their learning. So I was in a coaching session with an amazing history teacher, and she really wanted to explore this idea. And so the first thing that we did was we articulated, what is it that you're trying to assess student progress toward? What was the desired result for this particular unit? What was the destination that you wanted all students to get to in terms of their learning? And that desired result is standards informed, right? We use our standards as teachers, what students need to know or be able to do to inform the design of a unit that's really working toward a specific desired result. And when we design our assessments, we want to make sure the assessment is very closely aligned with that desired result. So she and I worked together to identify the desired result. Then we went from that to identifying what assessment strategy or strategies could we use to measure student progress toward that desired result. And so what we ended up finding out is that she could provide students multiple pathways to demonstrate that they had reached that desired result. Typically, she would have them all writing an essay to demonstrate their understanding of key concepts, pulling from resources that they covered throughout the unit. Instead of only offering that written option, we also decided to allow students to, because basically they were answering an essential question for the unit, and they had to draw on the resources and information from the unit to support the answer to that essential question. So there was still a writing option. They could write an essay answering the essential question and pulling together the resources and information from the unit. They could also create an infographic, right? This visual display of information to answer the essential question, citing specific resources, including data, statistics, and information in that infographic, that kind of more artistic form of visual representation of information. And then the third option was to record and kind of produce an original podcast answering the essential question and pulling together information to support the answer to that question. And once we had those three different products that students could create, or three different artifacts students could create to demonstrate their learning, she still hit that bump of, wait, how do I assess three different products, right? Am I going to need three different rubrics? And I said, no. We want to think about what were the standards, the specific standards that you used to drive the design of this unit and inform that desired result or that outcome you are working toward. We want to take those same standards and use them to design our rubric. So the criteria of the rubric would be standard aligned. And I told her, just choose the kind of three criteria. Let's try to keep it narrow so she's not trying to assess 10 different things, because I think that's also a trap, especially when we get to the end of the year. We feel like we have to grade every single aspect of every single artifact that students create. We don't. Being very specific or very kind of focused in terms of what we're assessing, not only does that make our lives easier, but from a student perspective, if we're assessing three criteria instead of 10, it's much easier for them to understand, what is that assessment actually telling me about my skill set? 10 is so many for them to try to understand and take in and think about. So really limiting your criteria so that you're not overloading yourself in terms of the grading, and not overwhelming students by providing so much information about the different aspects of this product that it actually just kind of blurs together from their perspective. So we chose our three criteria that we were going to focus on, and then we created that mastery-based rubric of four levels: beginning, developing, proficient, mastery. And we described what each of those criteria look like at each level of mastery. And if you're not using AI regularly for rubric design, I would highly encourage you to play around with it. right? Putting in the standards, having it kind of tell you what criteria would be appropriate, and then helping you develop that language so that when it comes time, especially if we're talking about end of the year summative assessments that students aren't going to be taking and improving, that way you can just circle the language on the rubric and students can read, oh, this is what my teacher saw in my work for this criterion. Oh, this is what she or he or they saw on this particular one. So really being thoughtful about the rubric design can actually cut down the amount of time we spend grading because we don't feel the pressure to have to cover whatever the student work is in comments and suggestions and questions. Instead, we just circle language on a rubric. Maybe we write a comment at the bottom of the rubric and then we move on. All right, the last question. You encourage sustainable grading practices. What do you mean? How do we keep grading sustainable? And I get it. I think that the implication here is grading is so cumbersome. It's like never ending. And I think part of the issue is teachers feel this pressure to grade everything. You know, if we don't grade it, will students do it? That's a fear I hear all of the time. But at the end of the day, if we are grading everything, we're taking it into our evenings and weekends, it really robs us of the time and space to rest and recharge, to maybe think about designing a lesson for students. I would caution teachers not to try to grade everything just to provide that carrot or incentive for students to do the work. Instead, I want teachers to be really intentional about what they grade and why. So, for example, I use a very simple flow chart when I'm coaching teachers. It's one I developed when I was teaching that asks the question, what is the purpose of work? If the purpose of work is it's review or practice, maybe kids are, you know, practicing problems or responding to questions as a form of review, either in the classroom or for homework, my contention is let's not scoop all that practice and review up and grade it. First of all, if we start putting grades on practice and review, then we take away what should be a safe space to make mistakes, to fail, and to learn from those mistakes. So instead of grading practice and review, what I would love to see is teachers who are building a reflective kind of metacognitive practice around that, where they position the student to work on their own with a peer as part of a group, using an answer key, or maybe comparing their work to a really strong example and engaging in a self-assessment practice. So if they have an answer key, they can work with a partner or a group or on their own to check it against their own work, see if they can figure out why they missed the ones that were incorrect. If not, circle those so they can get additional help from a teacher or a classmate. If it is a work that's more organic, like a piece of writing, the teacher could create a really strong exemplar. Again, AI can be hugely helpful in creating exemplars to use in these moments and give students a very simple rubric to complete as they engage in the self-assessment, looking at their work, comparing it to the exemplar, and trying to identify the language on the rubric they think really reflects where they're at in terms of their skills and abilities. I think there's a lot of value in having students be the critical thinkers looking at their work and really trying to understand their specific progress. What did they do well? Where do they need to spend more time developing? If the purpose of work is that students are working toward a product, but they're in the process, right? So maybe it's they're writing a formal essay or a lab report or a research paper, or maybe they're working on a project of some kind or a performance task. As students are working, I'd love to see teachers building in class time for students to make progress on that work and then really dedicate the teacher time and energy in that class to giving very focused, actionable feedback. That way, kids have dedicated time to work in class because we know a lot of them aren't going home to environments that are super conducive to them being able to focus maybe on their work. They might not have a quiet environment. They might not have all the materials or the support they need to be successful. So building in class time for them to work and really focusing our energy on that focused, actionable feedback to support them as they work. That way, we're also not taking all that feedback back into our lives beyond the classroom. The final part of the flowchart, the question says, you know, What is the purpose of work? And if the work is a finished product or an assessment, that's when we're grading. And we're grading with standard aligned rubrics. And I encourage teachers, enter each of those standard, each of the scores separately, so that in your grade book, it's really clear what you assess, the different aspects of this assignment, and what specific scores off this mastery scale students earned. That way the student and their family really understand what the grades mean. Because so often if we grade a big project, a writing assignment, a performance task, we're kind of lumping all of the points together into one big lump score. So for years, I did this with essays where students might get an 82 out of 100. You know, it's a B minus. It's not a bad grade, but it doesn't provide a lot of insight into how strong was their thesis? How strong were their claims? Did they choose really good evidence to support those claims? How did they do when it came to analyzing their evidence? So if I enter each of those scores separately, here's the score for claims, here's the score for quality of evidence, here's the score for analysis and explanation. Now it's really clear where is the student doing quite well and where might they be struggling and need additional support. So long story short, I would love teachers to grade less and by doing so, create more time and space for themselves to engage in some of these more high impact aspects of their job, right? Whether that's designing really cool student-centered learning experiences, whether it's finding ways to give feedback in the classroom, or just enjoying an evening outside of school to rest, recharge, and get ready for that next week. And I know that grading practices are kind of controversial, but if you're finding that grading does feel unsustainable, then it's time to just pause and really think about what am I grading and why? And am I grading with rubrics that make the grading process easier and more streamlined for me and hopefully create more clarity for learners about why they're earning specific grades? All right, so super secret question. Let's see what this has to say. Okay, so note to listeners, Catelyn is a very healthy eater. This is true. I like healthy food. What is your cheat food? Okay, this is easy. French fries. I love savory food. If I am gonna cheat, it's gonna be with French fries. The bigger the basket, the better. The more salt. Yes, I'm here for French fries all day, every day. I want to thank you all for joining me for this episode of The Balance. If you have questions about anything related to education, teaching, designing lessons, assessing lessons, or even just finding balance in life, please send them my way. I would love to hear from you. I want to integrate these into future Ask Catelyn episodes. You can find me on X at Catelyn_Tucker, or on Instagram at Catelyn Tucker, or on my website, CatelynTucker.com. I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your week.